Thank you, Alan, for those songs. It's always good for us to be worshiping God together, as we get to do every week, multiple times a week. You know, it's good. It's a blessing. We're going to be starting in Psalm 37 here this evening. If you want to turn to Psalm 37 and verse 1, or I've got it up here on the screen as well. Psalm 37 and verse 1 says, "Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers." It's kind of a remarkable warning, isn't it? To not be envious of wrongdoers. I think this is worth digging into a bit to understand where this envy might come from, why it's warned against, how we beat that. There's a lot of interesting things for us to consider. So, why envy? Let's look at this verse again and see if we can figure out some more of what's going on. The beginning there, the "fret not," it's kind of an interesting word choice, and it's one that most of the major translations share. But I don't know, when I see the word "fret," I think worry, just simply worrying. And there is a component to that, but the Hebrew word involved here is about more than just worry. This is not the way, like we talked about this morning, of worrying where your next meal is going to come from, the anxiety of that. This "fret not" has worry to it, but it also has anger or burning behind it. So don't be angry and worried over evildoers. And it can't be a righteous anger, because it's immediately followed by this warning that we're considering today. Don't be angry, don't be worried, and especially don't envy them. And I don't know, at first glance, that is just a surprising mixture of emotions to put all together. Worry, anger, envy, all directed toward the same group of people. But it does actually make a lot of sense if we can dig into this a little bit. In Proverbs 23 and verse 17, we have a similar passage with a different ending to it. It says, "Let not your heart envy sinners, but continue in the fear of the Lord all the day." This time we're given a contrast. We're given something else to do instead of envying sinners. It says, "Don't envy them. Instead, continue in the fear of the Lord." And now I think the pieces should start coming together for us. Sometimes we look at sinners with some confusion. There are people who don't believe in God, people who maybe even are quite hostile toward God or even the concept of God. And we think, why doesn't God do anything about that? Why don't they get a clear sign that they're wrong? You try sharing the gospel with somebody and they say, God's not real. You believe in a fairy tale. And we kind of wish the heavens would open for just a moment and for God's hand to come down and wag his finger and just say, no, you need to believe. I am here. Some sort of sign, something. Maybe one little piece of brimstone to come down and barely miss them so that they might get scared into believing that, yes, God does exist. We don't see that, though. They don't get that clear sign from heaven that God exists, and so they continue in their delusion. We see people who resist God so strongly, fight against God, against his church, and they're not getting punished for it. They seem to get along just fine. There's no smiting. There's no thunderbolt from heaven. No fire and brimstone to actually destroy them. And we read of cases in the Bible where God actually did do things like that sometimes. You know, Uzzah struck dead when he touched the ark. Why doesn't God do any of that anymore? Maybe the occasional smiting would make things easier. Well, then we also look at the people who believe in God, but they're not obedient to him. And in some ways, that's even worse. Because they believe in God, and they love him, or so they say, but they won't do what he says. And sometimes that makes me angry. Because they get along just fine. They don't seem to have anything different going on in their lives. They get to do all these different things. They get to enjoy themselves, and they're not bound to the same burdens that I am. And so there's even a little bit of envy there. Why do I have to go through so much more trouble and effort for nothing? The proverb told us, don't be envious of sinners, but continue fearing God. But why should we? There doesn't seem to be any difference in outcome. There doesn't seem to be any difference in treatment from God. We see the exact same result either way. Sinners seem to be able to do whatever they want to do, whatever flavor it is that's important to them, whether they're going to resist God entirely or whether they're going to hold on to some version of a belief in God. They wake up in the morning just like we do. They go on with their lives, and there is no real difference. But let's ask a question here. I said that in this envious little monologue here, that sinners get to do whatever they want to do. Sinners are not bound to the same burden. But let's challenge it for a moment. Is that even a good thing? Is it a good thing to be able to do whatever you want to do? Well, we love freedom. We hate people telling us what we ought to do. But actually, it's not good to have unfettered freedom. It is not good to have no restrictions and to do whatever you think is best. Let me call your attention to the law of Moses as an example. We study something like Galatians or Hebrews about how the new covenant is better and the old covenant had to die. There's this contrast given that the old covenant could not forgive sins. It didn't have the full atonement within it. It didn't have the real solution for sin. It wasn't God's permanent plan for his people, and so it had to fade away. It had to be closed out, not just fading away to be forgotten, but it had to be fulfilled and closed out and replaced with a better covenant. And in fact, Galatians goes so far as to say that the law was, in effect, a curse to Israel because they couldn't keep it perfectly. And we studied through the first few chapters of Galatians some weeks ago, and that's a very thought-provoking book there, and a thought-provoking few lessons, because we see that the law was given by God, therefore it should be good, and it is good, but in effect, because they couldn't keep it, it became a curse to them. That's the effect of the rigidity of the law without a mechanism for grace and a mechanism for repentance. So our conclusion is that grace is better, Christ is better, and we're glad to have the covenant that we have today. But in all of that talk in Galatians and in Hebrews of the law, it was not as good as the new law, that Christ is better, the new covenant is better, it's important that we note that that doesn't mean that the old law was bad. It was not an evil thing. It was good. It didn't have the mechanism for grace within it. It did not have the atonement for sins within it. It only had the blood of bulls and goats. And without, you know, sinless perfection, it was not going to reconcile man to God. But it was good. When you read through it, you gain such an appreciation for the pattern that God had for the nation of Israel. We've been going through Deuteronomy in a Sunday morning class here. We've previously studied the law in other contexts before as well. You might read it on your own as well. And you see that God wanted what was best for his people. That was one of our themes this morning, right? God knows us. He wants what is good for us. He knows us so intimately that he knows what is proper and right for us and wants to bless us. Well, part of that is in the law that he gives us. And the law that he gave to Israel was good and was intended to be a blessing. And so when you look at what they are told to do, you can look at it on one hand as this long list of restrictions and codes and rules and, you know, consequences. Or you can look at it as outlining a version of society the way that God sees it. A nation the way that God sees it. A nation where parents take care of their children and teach them about God. A nation where children take care of their aging parents as they are approaching death. A nation where husbands and wives have committed and faithful relationships with each other, are not leaving the bounds of their marriage and breaking up homes elsewhere, but have good, solid, committed relationships with each other, giving stability to the family unit. A nation where business is conducted honorably, where you can trust that your neighbor is going to treat you fairly. A nation where neighbors watch out for each other, where everyone is encouraged to be productive and hardworking, where the poor are provided for generously, where the people enjoy the blessing of a fruitful land, where parents could leave an inheritance for their children, where accidents are resolved fairly, where injustices are punished appropriately, and where people worship God zealously. That sounds pretty great. And if our nation worked like that, we'd be better off. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Because we have a lot of imperfection and sin that messes things up. And we're not under the old law today. But nevertheless, we see that God does have a vision for his creation and a pattern that if we followed, that things would go better. So could there be a better paradise than that? To do things God's way, to have things working out just the way that he intended. For the time that we are put here upon the earth, God has a vision for what our lives here should look like, what our relationships with each other should be, the way that we interact with people in our community, the way that we operate as a church. That is good. Now, Israel failed to live up to that standard almost constantly, and so it ended up not being good for them, as tends to be the case when you break God's law. It turns out when you do things the opposite of what God intends, it becomes very, very bad, and lots of bad things happen, and you bring all sorts of curses upon yourself, both directly from God and indirectly, because God's rules are not arbitrary. His law is good and results in a better society, a better community, a better family, a better everything. That's what God wanted for them. That's what he gave them as a pattern to follow. And so the people back then who didn't respect God, they didn't bother following his commands, and so they had a type of freedom, a freedom to do whatever they wanted. Did it make Israel better? Did it make their families better? Did it make their lives better? They thought that it did. They had the freedom to run their lives right into the ditch. It got them nowhere. So when we look enviously at how sinners get to do whatever they want to do, it really is a short-sighted and foolish sort of attitude. It's like driving on the interstate and saying, I don't want to be bound by these rules. The road, it is confining. It keeps me to this one path. I want to go into the ravine. The ravine seems great. Sure it does. Until you've crashed your car at the bottom of it. God's rules, God's laws are there for a reason. They're there because he loves us, because he wants what is best for us. And so sin is overrated. Law is good. But sin is also overrated because it is short-lived. In Hebrews 11, verses 24 through 26, it says, by faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Moses had opportunity for an easy life. He's the adopted grandson of Pharaoh. His path is set. He could live comfortably, maybe even extravagantly. He could get himself to some powerful position in Pharaoh's court. He could probably even take care of his parents. Remember, his real mother was hired to be his nursemaid and probably remained in his life to some degree after that. If Moses wanted to try to have it both ways, he could be in Pharaoh's court and still be able to claim an affection and care for his real mother and not have to reveal who she was. And it would actually make sense to people that he might want to take care of her and take care of, you know, her husband, her, you know, the people who are actually his family. If anybody even cared that Moses was really a Hebrew, which they would have known, but would have cared that he was actually their son, he could have easily hidden it and taken care of them. That's a strong motivation right there, because his parents are slaves. His parents have a hard life, and he has the opportunity to shower them with wealth if that's what he chooses. Not to mention having the wealth for himself, for his own family that he would create. But he knew that the treasures of Egypt were just fleeting pleasures. Egypt was oppressing God's people, Moses' people. And God was not going to let that stand forever. So who is Moses going to throw his lot in with? Why would he side with the people who are fighting against God? In the short term, it looks like a great decision. In the short term, he's got the treasure and the pleasure. But how would Moses have fared during the 10 plagues? How would Moses have fared during the Exodus? He certainly wouldn't have been the deliverer. God would have raised up somebody else to lead the people out, to bring judgment upon Egypt, and Moses would have suffered instead of being rewarded and instead of being a tool in God's hand. So Moses did the right thing, and that's why in Hebrews 11, he is regarded as a hero of faith, as somebody that we should emulate, because he chose the good long-term plan. Even though it looked senseless at first to anyone with that temporary focus, it truly was the right decision. And so back to Psalm 37, where we started, you know, we had that admonition against an envious anger toward the wicked, but we're given the big picture that corresponds to Moses' story really well. In Psalm 37, verse 2, this is just one verse after where we were before, it says, "For they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb." In the envious, angry monologue that I had at the beginning of this lesson, you know, we said there's no difference between the righteous and the sinner. They have the same end. They have the same, good and bad things in life. It's just their life is easier and they have more freedom. That's not the case. In reality, a different end is coming. It hasn't come yet, but that doesn't mean that it's not coming. There is a difference in the final end of those who choose to serve God versus those who choose to walk their own way. We're angry because they're getting away with it, but they're not. We're envious because they get to do whatever they want, but judgment lies around the corner. There's a lot of things that we can see even in this life that work like that, even in physical things, that in the short term there is no difference, but in the long term, there are huge differences. What's the difference between somebody who saves for retirement their whole working life versus someone who never puts a penny away? For a while, looks like no difference. Maybe the person who's not putting anything away has lots and lots of money to spare. But come retirement, there's a difference. Come retirement, one person has let savings multiply and has something to protect and something to rely on. That's one of many examples in this life of how there can be a short-term delusion to our actions, but a long-term consequence. And let me tell you, the judgment that awaits us is so much more important than retirement. It's so much more important than any sort of preparation like that, because whether you're prepared for retirement or not, eventually this life is going to end. And eventually you have to answer for what you have done. Eventually you are called on the carpet to face the music. Have you been pleasing to God or not? In Psalm 1, turn over to Psalm 1, please. I don't have this one up on the screen. Psalm 1, it's a short, well-known psalm, but it shows a good explanation of the difference between the man who is rooted in righteousness and the wicked one who follows paths of sin. Psalm 1, verse 1, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water, but yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous, for the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." The righteous man has to watch. He has to be careful. He has to get advice and then consider whether it's wise or not. He has to be able to discard the advice of sinners. He has to choose to not go along with them in their sin. In that way, he is strange and different. He is restricted and enslaved. But he takes delight in God's law. He's meditating on that law. He's following it. He's obeying it. He's grounded and rooted in it. And so, like that tree planted by streams of water, he is strong. He is blessed. He can resist any storm that comes. He is well nourished, well provided for, to plug into this morning's lesson. And in the end, he stands. The wicked are like chaff. Chaff is just the dust, the specks of that outer layer of a crop. It's nothing. It blows away with the slightest breeze. And remember this, there's more than a breeze coming. There's a storm of God's judgment that is brewing. When it comes, the wicked cannot hope to stand. We don't want to be chaff. We don't want to be dust in the wind to be blown away and destroyed. We want to be the tree that is sustained by God and sustained by his word, so that we will stand in the judgment. You'll remember that one of our envy passages, the second one we looked at, was Proverbs 23:17. Well, that also has an additional thought in the next verse, verse 18. Gives us another reason to continue in the fear of the Lord. It says, "Surely there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off." So we were told, don't envy the wicked, don't envy the sinner, continue in the fear of the Lord. And here, "Surely there is a future, your hope will not be cut off." This verse hits me in two different ways. One, there is a future, and your hope will not be cut off. The hope of the wicked is for satisfaction, for peace, for enjoyment, for fulfillment in this life. The devil is lying to them. And that is a lie that fades over time, a hope that fades over time, until it is finally revealed as the emptiness that it's always been. And so there is a future. Their hope will not stand. Their hope will be cut off and will wither away. Your hope will not. Your hope stands and is firm. But the other way it hits me is that there is a future, and the hope that you are waiting for is secure. The hope you are waiting for is assured. Why do we follow God? We follow him because we fear judgment. We fear that storm of judgment that's brewing. We want to be more of a chaff. But more than that, we have grown to love him and to recognize all that he does for us. We wait for the reward that he promises us. We are not motivated only by fear and terror. We trust that he wants what is best for us. We trust that God is a good God and that he's seeking to make our lives better here when we follow his word, and especially better in the life to come through the final judgment, the final reward. Because we are not afraid of God's judgment. Not when we stand secure. Not when we are his followers. We stand secure knowing that we don't deserve anything, knowing that we are not worthy, but knowing that God has exalted us and that God has given his grace to us and that he wants us to be with him. All of that secure hope is shaken when we are deceived into thinking that none of this matters. When we're looking at the wicked and we have that combination of worry that they're getting away with it, of anger that they get to do something that I don't get to, and envy that, well, they get to do something that I don't get to, and I wish I could. And that horrible mixture of emotions makes me want to be like the sinner and not stand in my hope in God. Can't last very long like that. You won't have the endurance to stay faithful to God if you're looking longingly back at Sodom. Even if God doesn't turn you into a pillar of salt, you're going to go back anyway. How sad. How terrifying. When we worry that things are up to chance or that the freedom of sinners is better, it inevitably causes us to have a fractured faith and to drift away from God. So don't fear. Don't doubt. Your hope is secure. In Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 10, this is the beginning of kind of a long explanation, a long a list of things that sinners will do. Solomon's talking to his son, trying to prevent his son from making some terrible decisions. And so he starts off by saying, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent." And he goes on into the different ways that they might entice him. There's some who are enticing him to be violent and to be greedy. There are some who are enticing him to be sexually impure. There are some who are enticing him to make all manner of foolish decisions. But again, this word entice tells us that there's something attractive about this. Nobody would sin if there weren't something attractive about sin, if it didn't have some shine and some allure to it. The only reason why anybody makes that terrible choice to be disobedient to God. If sinners entice you, do not consent. They might entice you by directly asking you to sin, by directly pressuring, pushing you to sin, or they might do it indirectly through that envy that builds up within you. As you're looking at someone else's life and saying, "I like the way that they are. I like the freedom that they have." That freedom is not all it's cracked up to be. In James 4, it says, "Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you." God's call to us, our duty, our charge is to cleanse our hands, to draw near to God, to seek after him, and to be assured that when we do that, he will draw near to us. He is good, he is gracious, he is loving, he wants us to come to him. And so as we have our hearts purified and our double-mindedness becomes a pure, single-minded desire to follow God, we humble ourselves before him, we push aside all of the sin, all of the desire and the envy and the worry and the anger and all these things, so that we can be exalted by Him someday. And brethren, this is good. It is good for us now, and it is good for us later. It is good because God promises that it is good. I hope that this is an encouraging message to us, because we as human beings are short-sighted. We lose track of what really matters and what our end goal is. So do not be deceived into thinking that it's all up to chance. Getting too cynical or nihilistic in thinking that we all end up the same anyway. We absolutely do not. It matters what you do. It matters how you live. And you will have a better life now and a better hope in the future by following God. Thank you for your attention. If you are convicted in your need to become a Christian, your need to follow God and to serve Him, we can help you with that. We can baptize you and your sins can be washed away, and you can become a disciple of Jesus Christ. If you need any help at all, if you need our prayers, you need encouragement, you need forgiveness of sins, God offers all of these things to you. And we are happy to help you as tools in the Lord's hand. We want to be a blessing to you as you can be a blessing to us. And so whatever your need is, come forward as we stand and sing.